Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
The business which I started many years ago, which I sold out of in 2012, we actually did all the pioneering of the Outer Islands and destinations. And that business came to abrupt halt when we actually had one of our boats taken by pirates. But they took the boat and they took the crew of eight, and they took them and they had the crew for 79 days in Somalia. And they eventually burnt the ship, and that closed our business.
That was Keith Rosinus with his first pirate story. Heading back to the Seychelles today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how are you doing today? Thanks for stopping by the show. If you've been enjoying this podcast and want to show your support, one way to do that is to click over to any of our sponsors' websites and check in with them there. And one of those sponsors is Fishhound Expeditions. Fishhound puts together remote Alaskan float trips to get you in the middle of Alaska to get the full experience. This is that experience you've been dreaming about, mousing for trout, stripping for coho, char, etc., etc. It's the way to do it in remote Alaska on a river trip. Head over to wetflyswing.com/fishhound to find out more. That's F-I-S-H. H-O-U-N-D. We are also sponsored by Lake Lady Rods, building distinctive custom rods, each created one at a time to the exact specifications for each angler. I just got back from a Stillwater trip to Kamloops and had the four weight out with a sinking line using that clear camo. The thing was casting like a dream. This thing is really nice. I can't even explain how Chris does it, but it's very unique and very nice to cast. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/lakelady right now, LAKELADY, to support this podcast and a great rod builder. Keith Rosinus shares his story of fishing some of the greatest destinations around the world. We find out how it all got started out of South Africa and how he stepped up to build a guiding business around one of the most sought after destinations around the world. I know you're going to enjoy this one, so this one has a little tips, a little tricks, and a decent amount of history, including the connection of Keith and I with the last name. I think we might actually have some family connection, so stay tuned for that one. So without further ado, here he is, Keith Rosinus from Alphons Fishing Company. How's it going, Keith?
Oh, good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for taking a little time to put this together. I know you've done a number of these podcasts. I always love to check in on that first, you know, on the podcasting space. We're going to talk a little about that. Do you have any idea how many podcast episodes you've done with other shows?
No idea, because I enjoy them so much.
Good. Well, I'm going to try to keep this interesting and maybe ask you a few questions that you haven't been asked before. So that'll be the goal here. But you've obviously, you know, the Seychelles is a huge name, even for people that maybe will never get there. You hear a lot about it, how amazing it is. So we're going to dig into a little bit on that and talk about some of the species there. But take us back. I know you have your connection to your grandfather and your, you know, a long history in fly fishing. Just take us back to how you first got into it, and then we'll jump into how Alphons fishing got going.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always fly fished. My grandfather was a big fly fisherman and fly tyer. So he taught me all the traits of fly fishing. Basically started fishing for trout in my younger days at the age of 5 or 6 up in Troutbeck in Rhodesia, and then obviously also in South Africa, and Gubu Dam and those kind of areas. And then sort of evolved into saltwater. You know, obviously we've got a sea here in South Africa. We're surrounded by a sea. So it was in its infant stages of fly fishing in the salt, but we had a go at it. And obviously, as you progress in that lust for, as a youngster, for broader places, and more diverse and wild places, different species, sort of led me on to the Seychelles. Now, I was very fortunate to get to the Seychelles. My father took me there, and obviously once there, you realize what an amazing place it is. But it did take time. There was a light bulb moment when I'd been there and I'd gone back and fished other places around the world and realized that, the Seychelles is the place. So yeah, I mean, it's a long story. I hope you guys have got some time, and I can touch on it when you would like me to.
Yeah, no, that's good. We'll probably dig into a little more of that as we go. I'm curious on the trout fishing. So take us to South Africa. What does that look like? How is trout fishing there different from, say, trout? And I'm not sure, are you talking rainbow trout?
We have rainbows and browns. So there's some stream and river areas closer to Johannesburg, which is where I'm currently now. But obviously, there's also a lot of lakes on the higher areas, Drakensberg and those kind of areas. Obviously, trout are all stocked. They're all stocked into South Africa, and they've become residents here. We get big trout. We've got beautiful big lakes, crystal clear, but we've also got really nice big rivers as well as coming out of the Sutu and those kind of places. I would say that my most favorable fishing at the moment for trout would be in Lesotho, which is a country which is surrounded by South Africa. It's a mountain kingdom, and there's some great fishing up there. In those rivers, you also get yellowfish as well. So some rivers you'll be able to catch rainbows, browns, and yellowfish. There are some great fisheries here in South Africa.
No, that's cool. And I'm glad you mentioned the yellowfish. Remind me, so how do you spell that country that's surrounded by South Africa?
Lesotho, Lesotho, I think. Lesotho. I think it's spelled like that.
Gotcha. Yeah, gotcha. Cool. So this is kind of like a natural area in the middle of South Africa. What is that? I know you have a big conservation, that's a big part of what you do. What does that look like in actually the mainland of South Africa and around, is that a big, is conservation a topic out there?
Yeah, conservation is all around us. Obviously, we've got some amazing game and wildlife. So most of your conservation is obviously focused on animals, and there needs to be a lot more focus on the rivers and the dams and the fish, because obviously there's a lot of areas or rivers running through informal settlements. South Africa has obviously had a lot of mining in the past, very 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 rich in gold and also some minerals. So a lot of those rivers have been polluted to the extent where there's no more fish in them. So I don't know if we will ever get to a stage of rehabilitation on some of the rivers, but I do know down in the Natal area, which is a coastal area, there's some stuff happening on the river. So hopefully we'll be able to highlight the fact that a lot of these rivers can be rehabilitated and we can focus on them. But at the moment I'm focusing all my effort on the Seychelles. We have all our operations there. All the islands are exclusive in a sense where there's only one lodge or hotel on each one of the outer islands. So we have the ability to form foundations and sort of conservation arms with conservationists and do all the monitoring and conservation programs through fundraising and so forth. So a lot easier there. Whereas here in obviously in South Africa, a river flows through many different townships and informal areas and cities and towns. And it's very hard to sort of, obviously create a positive impact on those kind of rivers. But there is hope for the future, I suppose.
Yeah, gotcha. So you're in the Seychelles, and you've been there like what now? How long have you been in the Seychelles working, guiding out there?
So I've been going to Seychelles for about 25 years. I think I've been guiding there for about over 23 years. I did 17 years straight where I did Seychelles, either Russia or African destinations, guiding back-to-back seasons. And then I hung up my boots, and unfortunately I had to anchor myself in my office and start building a business for the future. So most of my time is spent in the office now, unfortunately, but I do fish a hell of a lot.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, describe the Seychelles really quick, just for, you know, you hear a lot about it, you see photos, pictures, stuff like that. But what makes it so special compared to maybe some other saltwater experiences?
Yeah, so a lot of people sort of get confused with, you know, Seychelles in the sense where, you know, they're granitic islands, where, you know, the inner islands are all granitic. So they have large mountains, big black mountains, granitic mountains that come out of the sea kind of thing. Whereas when you move away from the main islands where our destinations start, our closest one being about an hour in a plane, it is coral atolls. So it's very different to other places around the world. So, you know, many millions of years ago, there would have been a volcano, and obviously the matter of the volcano is heavier than the sea matter, and slowly it would have sunk into the seabed. But as it was sinking in the seabed and the tip of the volcano sort of submerged, the coral would keep growing towards the sun. And you'd get the coral would grow up, and then obviously you'd get deposits from the currents that would form on top of that coral. And that will create the atolls. So a lot of these places have got lagoons. Some of them don't have lagoons where half the atoll has fallen away and it's just sort of a half moon shaped island or atoll. Whereas a lot of them have got enclosed lagoons. And the beauty about them is that, you know, on each one of these sort of atolls, you know, you can have numerous islands. For instance, you know, Alphonse group of atolls, there was three atolls very close to each other. You know, they basically have a 1 mile channel between them kind of thing. You know, so from Alphonse, it's the only atoll which we have a hotel on and a fishing operation. And we run from there to Saint-Francois, which takes us about 25 minutes in a fast boat, or actually 15 minutes in a fast boat and 25 minutes in a slow boat. And you're fishing an atoll which has never been inhabited. And right next to it is another atoll. So you have all these amazing experiences. For instance, Cosmolito is an atoll and has about 20 islands, 20 small islands. So you have this one atoll where we've got an eco lodge on the point of the main island. And then we go out and fish all these other areas in the lagoon, you know, 30 kilometers across the lagoon, fishing beautiful islands which, you know, I've never seen humans or never had humans inhabit them, and really wild and beautiful.
Wow! So the atoll is essentially historically it was a volcano that collapsed that created that. Is that correct?
That's correct, John. They're labeled coral atolls.
Coral, yeah. So it's coral. So the life is, and that's what makes them so diverse. That's why they're known as, even that area might be known as the most diverse aquatic area maybe on the planet, something like that.
So there was a survey done with it's called the Norton survey, which was done with a ship which had something along those lines, had two submarines, and they actually declared it a Stove Cosmolito area as the most marine diverse area in the world.
There you go. So it is, and yeah. You see it when you're out there, and I guess part of that is the obviously the fly fishing, which we're going to talk about today, but you must just see numerous species of plants, animals, birds. It's just kind of like, you know, is it pretty amazing?
Well, the thing is that, you know, in the early days, it was always about chasing fish and, you know, about catching as many fish as you can kind of thing for yourself and for the clients. You know, in the old days, when I first came out, I fished, and then, you know, obviously evolved into the guiding side of things. But, you know, when you used to come out to these places, you always walked on the flats and you saw these amazing things and encounters, birds, sharks, turtles, all sorts of animals and fish. And you always thought, you know what, geez, I mean, I wonder if a ecotourism-oriented person or a leisure person would enjoy it. So, you know, over the years, it's kind of evolved from just being a fishing-oriented, fly fishing-oriented business to a business which has actually grown, and we actually bring more people to the Seychelles to do ecotourism and leisure oriented stuff than we do fly fishing. And the beauty about that is that by being able to do that is you take the focus away from putting too much, you put the focus on putting too much pressure on the flats and the fisheries, and you're able to rest them by creating revenue on the other side.
That's amazing. Yeah, that is a cool. That's kind of how, you know, business should work, right? You've evolved it from the start of focus. So when you started, you were really focused all fly fishing, and now it's evolved into where now it's fly fishing is even secondary to other just ecotourism.
Yeah, I mean, fly fishing is our most important aspect because I love it so much. But we do take, we've taken our foot off the pedal with regards to trying to reduce the amount of rods that we put at each destination and increase the ecotourism. And then that way, you know, it's obviously more sustainable for the future. We've got a lot of work to do with regards to that kind of, you know, role. Obviously, with the more destinations that we have, we're able to spread the load a lot better.
Yeah, let's go. Well, let's. People are here today to hear about fishing. I want to hear about it all. So we'll probably circle back around to some of this other stuff. But let's dig into the fly fishing a little bit. So what are, you know, species wise? What's the big species people are coming? Is there one that people really go up there for, or is it just a multiple?
Yeah, I think you know, in the beginning, a lot of people come to Seychelles either for the mass amount of bonefish and the incredible amounts of bonefish that you can catch in some of the destinations all day long. But obviously one of the big draw cards is the giant trevally, you know, the ferocious giant trevally. But you know, once people come out, they obviously, a lot of people get hooked to them and they want to catch giant trevally all day long kind of thing. And it is, because it is addictive.
Yeah.
But you know, once you get there and you see all the other species that around you, you know, when you're fishing for the giant trevally, you're often in areas where there's bonefish. So you have big bonefish swimming around. And with, you know, obviously swimming amongst the bonefish, you'll often see permit. And then when you go up onto the pancake sort of coral ridges, or we call them pancake flats, you're obviously the tailing triggerfish. And then amongst, you know, amongst the those areas you're in the channels, you'll see the milkfish feeding, or on the flats, you'll see the milkfish feeding. So it's almost like the guys get drawn out there by catching bonefish or by catching GTs. But once they're there, they get hooked on all the rest. You know, the Indo-Pacific permit is exactly the same as the Atlantic permit. It's difficult. They are difficult. They wave their tail at you and stick their little fin up in the same way. it's just an amazing experience, you know. So the beauty about the Seychelles is obviously it's the crystal clear water, you know, and if you like wading, you can wade on white flats, white hard flats. We don't have flats where you end up sinking up into your thighs, you know, and you're trying to roll around in your stomach to try and get back the skiff kind of thing. We don't get that. So, you know, it really is amazing. And, you know, the beauty is that we have everything for everybody, you know, stuff for beginners. If they, you know, after catching, when you catch bonefish, get the iron and catch as many bonefish as possible, we have that. But then if you want to go and get more technical fish, you know, like permit and so forth, you know, you get plenty of shots. All the different destinations are unique. Some mm-hmm. better for permit, some better for GTs. And that's, gotcha. that's how we sell them or try and market them.
Gotcha. What is the one, if you're going to go out there, the one that really gets you fired up now, you know, if you're to go out there and fish for them, if you had to pick one?
For me, it's difficult because I'm kind of someone who prefers to walk around and just catch whatever comes my way and sort of pick the fish and then sort of, you know, if it looks like an interesting fish or a bigger fish or a, you know, in a difficult situation, whatever, I'll have a go at it. But you know, over the years, we've really worked hard on the Indo-Pacific permit. You know, in the beginning, you know, they were almost like a no-go kind of thing. We just couldn't catch them. And also, I think that, you know, the numbers of Indo-Pacific permit, because, you know, in the old days, I mean, they would have been netted, because they're obviously a fish with swimmers rounds on the nets. And, you know, it probably would have been a fish that people would have eaten. Whereas bonefish, I don't think they would have eaten. So I don't know if it's just the seawater temperatures that have changed or what's changed, but the Indo-Pacific permit fishing has definitely, well, numbers have definitely increased. So we've seen a lot more of them. And, you know, about, 5 years ago, we also evolved and managed to tweak a lot of different things on the Flexo crab to create the Alflexo, which is a small version, which is really, really realistic. And it's given us an opportunity to really target them, because they eat them. They like them. So it's gone from the fish of 1,000 casts to the fish of probably like 100 casts now. So,
Yeah,
so we've got them dialed in and we're enjoying them. And, you know, some destinations in the past, you wouldn't even fish them, because you would fish, you know, at permit all day and you wouldn't catch one for a month. And now we sort of got them dialed in where we catch them, you know, one trip is just finished to Providence. on board our catamaran called Cuvadis, where the guests, American guests, ended on 17 in the Pacific permit for the week. So we really got it dialed in, and it's something that, you know, and I mean, those guests, they loved it so much they booked and ready to come back again. So exactly. It's really amazing. There's something unique about staying on a catamaran.
Oh, right.
Four guests on a catamaran with skiffs in tow, or, you know, and then going on to a series of different islands, you know, and moving around between islands and fishing for Indo-Pacific permit, on foot, tailing fish, you know. So it's, we have got so many different products. I mean, it really is an amazing fishery.
Yeah, that is cool. That sounds amazing. I mean, when you talk about the catamaran, so this is and how big, these are big catamarans. How many feet, how big are these boats?
So the boat which we target our Indo-Pacific permit in the Amarantes chain is a 75-footer. And we can load our boats on board, and we can, yeah, it's got some top end as well, so we can travel like 16 knots. It's really comfortable and luxurious in a sense. So the guys really enjoy it.
That's sweet. So you got this luxurious, this catamaran that's out there. And well, let's just dig into the permit. It's pretty interesting because you talk about how back in the day you could barely catch them, and now you're catching them, and you said, you know, different patterns, things like that. What is the big difference? If you think back before where you were, it was taking you 1,000 casts and now it's 100. What is the big difference?
Very simple. It's the Alflexo, the creation of this new fly that we've evolved and really, really sort of focused on getting it exactly right.
How do you spell that?
It's Alphonse.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Flexer.
Yeah, Flexer. Yeah, Flex. PH though, not F.
Oh, PH. Yeah, Flexer. Yeah. So it says fly. So that goes against the general rule. And, you know, fly fishing gets pretty funny because everybody says lots of different species, you know, the fly isn't as important as the cast and everything. But really, with this permit, you're saying fly is the most important thing.
Absolutely, without a doubt. And also the way we fish them. So in the past, you know, you would kind of lay it up and you put a crab pattern out there, and you as he came towards it, you were sort of twitch. Whereas with this fly, we kind of fish him a lot faster. So you'd get it to the area where you think he's seen it, and you'd move it away from him immediately. So you get him to try and chase it. And once he's dialed on that fly and he's coming straight back towards you, he can't see the leader. All he can see is that fly. And then we generally speed up, but then give him a little bit of time to eat that fly, and then he'll be on. So yeah, it's you know, it's a combination of everything. So you got the right fly, you got the confidence. If you got the confidence, you can fish them in various different ways. Yeah. And if you got the confidence, you can make that fly that cost count versus trying to overthink it and lay it up too far away, snagging the bottom and so forth. Yeah. So it's all about the confidence. With permit, it's about confidence.
Yeah. And do you think the technique you're doing there with that fly and the fast twitch, does that work for permit all around the world?
Yeah, it's not really a twitch. Eh? It's actually a slow and steady strip.
Oh, slow and steady.
So just keeping their fly moving away from them. You know, in the past, we used to twitch it, and you know, thinking that maybe they think it's a little crab, they'll come after it. But no, they don't want it. There's a little bit of jack in them, so they like to chase.
So slow
it
and steady.
Bit.
So it's just like a slow, like a long, like kind of just like a long strip, and just keep long strips.
And in trying to get back onto the strip as quick as possible, because, you know, often within the Pacific permit, you feel a bump, it's too late. He's already eaten it and spit it out. They inhale it. They don't eat it. So,
oh, right. So how do you know when to do the set?
So generally when you're stripping those long, slow strips, not too slow, hey? So you'll feel a little bit of pressure. If you feel a little bit of pressure, I'll set straight away. Because generally it'll be inside its throat almost. If you feel the bump, it's too late. It's already out.
Yeah, right. This is cool. So, and talk a little bit about just the kind of the line, the fly line you're using in the gear, real quick. What's that look like?
Yeah, so we're using either 8 or 9 weight rods. Now I've gone back to 8 weight, and simply because you can, you know, when you're fishing an 8 weight, the line lands lighter because it's softer because it's lighter. And you know, and I've gone away from 9 weight, you know, because in the past, you know, obviously a 9 weight was a combination rod where you would fish for triggers and bonefish and in the Pacific permit with. Now what we generally do is we kind of fish 2 rods. So we'll have an 8-weight with a crab for a permit, and we'll have a 9-weight if we're going to fish for triggers and so forth. So, it's quite important that you don't fish something that's too heavy. Also in the past, the guys would fish 10-weight lines, but I believe that's too heavy. You know, it lands too hard on the water. You're already casting a heavy fly or a big crab pattern at them. So try and get as much splash away from them as possible. I fish light leaders. For Indo-Pacific permit, I'm fishing 15-pound. It's not so light, but it's light enough. You know, something that's really small diameter, fluorocarbon, long leader, 12 foot if you can. And just straight floating lines. That's the way. Just straight floating. You don't need anything simple.
And you're in pretty shallow. Like, how deep is the deepest you're fishing?
So if you're going to fish them as really deep, it'll probably be around thigh height, thigh depth. That's when the tide's pushed in and they're on the apex or around waist deep maximum. But generally you're fishing them knee and above the knee, and that's the perfect height. They're very comfortable in that depth of water.
Gotcha. And you guys are just from your going back to the catamaran. So you got your boats, you pop off, you got the little skiffs or whatever you use, and then you guys head out to a different atoll and then spend the day there. Is that how it works? And then meet back? Or are you fishing out of the boat, or you get going on shore?
Yeah. So we generally plan our week or 10 days, whatever amount of time the guests are with us, according to the tides. So certain atolls we'll fish on the Foster tides, in the spring tides. And certain atolls will fish on the neap tides. Generally, your spring tide destinations, you would be fishing inside a lagoon. So something that has an atoll which has a nice lagoon, and you'll go in on the high tide, and then obviously as the tide gets lower, you're stuck inside the lagoon if there's no entrance, and then you'll come back out in the high tide again. Those kind of atolls work really, really well for permanent spring tides. Generally, a lot more white sand and so forth. But then on the neap tides, we target the destinations which are more vulcanized, broken vulcanized, coral orientated, like storm ridges and so forth, where those permit are coming up on the flat and they sort of tailing on the broken coral. It's generally a little more difficult to catch as well, and that's on foot. But what we often do is, you know, in those kind of places, is we'll get into position to the area with our skiff, and then as it gets very, very skinny, we'll let the skiff run dry. And then we'll go on foot. Whereas, on the destination we have the spring tides, we like to keep the boats close to us. So we catch them on the pole, poling. But if you want to catch them on foot, you can catch them all on foot. It's just a matter of poling along, finding a pod of fish or a fish, and you can jump off the skiff and walk up and have a go.
This episode is sponsored by Trestle with their CRC system. It provides secure, convenient storage for your fully rigged fly rods with unsurpassed gear protection. Every CRC system comes with a secure mounting clamp system, padding in the reel compartment, and their proprietary rod liner suspension system. This is a very a pain point for, as a lot of us, your hook gets stuck in there and you can't get it out. That's definitely a pain. So they figured that one out. And it's all about making it easier and faster to get on the water and having your rod fully rigged, whether you're on the salt water, whether you're in California, Colorado, New York, it doesn't really matter. If you want your rod to be ready to go, the CRC system will do that. Whether on top of your rod, on top of your rig, on the side, or in the back of your car. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/trestle right now to get started. TRXSTLE. You support this podcast by clicking over through that link to Trestle. Okay, back to the show.
So good. So I think we got a little bit of a little perspective on it. We had a few questions here from listeners, and one was on knots. I'm just curious, when you're setting these things up, what does that look like for your knots? What type of knots? Give us it sounds like it's pretty straightforward, just a long leader, but break that down a little bit.
Are you talking about for Indo-Pacific permit, or are you talking about?
Yeah. If we just stick for permit, maybe let's start with permit. Just start with permit, and then we'll go in general.
Yeah. So, I mean, permit, we obviously using your standard floating line. I use Cortland lines, and they've got obviously braided. So they've got welded loops on the end. So it's nice and simple. I like to do a twisted leader or a ferrule leader, whatever you want to call it. So I'll basically take sort of. Three full lengths of my outstretched arms of 15-pound, I twist it back on itself to about halfway. And then what I do is I do a perfection, which is it's kind of difficult to do. I haven't seen anyone else do it, where you do a perfection on that twisted end. So you have basically have one long piece of leader. There's only one little knot there, and you obviously loop it into the welded loop. And then on the end, I'll put a perfection loop as well. I won't use a perfection loop on anything less than 15 pound. I find that it does break. But I mean, for Indo Pacific permit, you can use a tapered leader as long as it's got about 15 pound on the tip, the point. Some people use segmented leaders, so you know, obviously heavier butt section, all the way down to 15 pound. All of it works. And you know, for permit, it doesn't really make a massive difference, because generally where you're hooking them, you've got a bit of clearance. They're not going to run into coral. You don't have to put the brakes on. Well, they can run into coral, but you have to be unlucky. But you don't have to put severe brakes on them immediately. You know, you've got a little bit of leeway there. So you have got a bit of freedom on the tippet. But once you start going to all the other species like triggerfish and so forth, you know, you have to be very careful of what you use.
Gotcha. So when you go to the triggers and the GTs, that's a different setup you're using there?
Yeah, well, so GTs is a very different model, you know, very different experience, in the sense that, you know, he's the beast. You know, he breaks most things. You know, if he doesn't straighten the hook, you know, he has a go at cutting the fly line. So, you know, we've obviously spent a lot of time over the years evolving the tackle for Giant Rally. You know, the difference is that people think that, you know, you have to fish a really hard drag for a Giant Rally. Yes, you do, but you can't set it there. You've got to get it to that. So the way we do it is that we have a standard fly line. You know, it must be a saltwater, a tropic fly line, must have a proper core. Try and get it over 50-pound core at least. Definitely not a mono core. And if you can, I mean, try and stay away from sort of lines that have got too much texture on them, because you know a GT is going to, when you're clearing, he's going to cut holes in your fingers if you're dragging a textured line through your fingers.
Oh wow!
So it's just you want to have a line that's not too slippery on the fingers, not too oily, but not too much texture on it. So you know, something with a nice big head, so you can place the fly quite quickly, you know, and close to you, because 90% of the time you're not catching the Giant Valley, you know, full fly line cast away. You're catching them short, you know, 3-4 rod lengths maximum, you know, just putting the fly in front of him, and it's short, because they appear out of nowhere, you know. So it's quick and easy and getting the fly in as quick as possible to an area where you can see it. So we use general, you know, quite bulky heads on the fly lines. I've started fishing an 11 weight, a lot more than a 12 weight. You know, obviously 11 weight's more forgiving on your arm. You know, people who don't fish for Giant Valley all the time, you know, they'll find it much easier to cast an 11 weight than a 12 weight. You know, and it's more important to hook the fish than to land every single one. So, and all the new modern 11 weight rods have all got plenty of backbone. You point that rod at the fish, you're going to land him. Obviously, you need a really good saltwater reel that has plenty of break power. But the most important thing with the reel is that it mustn't have any frame flex when the drag is locked up. So a lot of people go, oh, but you know, the drag's great in this thing, but they don't understand that, you know, once that reel is locked up, you know, the frame will flex and you'll get that drag. Yeah. You know, that's kind of you know, grinding effect. So our fish Chilton reels, they're basic, simple. I can fix them with a Leatherman at any stage on the flats. So very, very easy for me to use and fix. And and I have been fishing the same reels for, you know, almost 15 years. So for me, that's the way forward. A simple cork drag, just make sure the cork drags don't get wet. And if they get wet, you just open the reel up and wipe it on your shirt and put it back together again. So, yeah, that kind of thing. You know, Abels, the old Abels all work really, really well. Makos work really, really, really well. Just a really good Nautilus, you know, just a really good saltwater reel, something that got breaks. With that drill is that, you know, when you hook the Giant Rally, you've got to have it set fairly tight, but not tight enough where he's going to eat and he's going to break you. So, because if you think you're casting to a fish, you're stripping the line in, he's coming, he's enticed, he's looking at you, his eyes are dilated, his mouth's open, his mouth's coming above the water edge, you're stripping as fast as he can, he eats the fly. you've got a lot of line around you. So you're gonna, that fish is going to start taking that line. The line's going to be going through your fingers. You're going to be trying as hold as on as tight as possible. But at some stage, that line is going to hit the reel. Now, if it hits the reel and your drag's tight, all that's going to happen is there's going to be a big explosion.
Right.
So what needs to happen is it needs to get on that reel with a nice sort of steady drag, but not too much. Let that nisha sort of start speeding up, and obviously then let the reel start speeding up. And as he starts going, then you tighten him down.
Yeah.
Generally, giant trevally aren't fish that are going to do numerous long runs. You don't really break their power. You're going to break their spirit. So in a sense, like it's slow pressure and sort of applying it in a sense where you get to a stage where you're flipping him. So as he's going away, you're applying. Knowing where your breaking point is, and then at a stage that GT won't be able to, you won't be able to keep going because you've slowed him down so much, and he'll do a flip. He'll probably do two or three other runs as well, and then he'll generally start looking for structure. That's when you've got to be clever. That's when you've got to try and get as close as possible to him, because he's going to look for any piece of coral, any sort of drop off, and he's going to go straight towards that. And if you can get close to him, you can omit that kind of thing. And then obviously it's just a little bit of a tug of war and. Until you got him close by you. So, yeah, the next important thing, obviously, with the fly line is the setup. So, we don't use braided loops at all, factory loops or braided loops that have been manufactured or made, with glue and so forth. We believe in using waxed running line, braided running line. So it's like Cortland makes a really good one. It's waxed. Running line, it used to be called wax running lines, 50-pound. You loop it back into itself, so you create a double layer of the running line, and then what you do is you feed your fly line about 4 inches to 5 inches up inside that braided loop, and then what you do is you use two nail knots at the back of the loop, the end of the loop, and you cinch it on that way. We don't put glue all over the braided loop. We only put it, if you want to put a little bit of glue, you can put it on the nail knots, because the reason why a braided loop is so good is because when it is stretched, it applies the grip to the whole part of the fly line that is underneath the braided loop versus just to one area. So what it does is gives you a lot more flexibility with regards to applying more pressure. And actually, you'll see when you've done a braided loop nicely, you'll see that once you've caught a fish in it, it actually seats onto the fly line. Creates all those little sort of ridges, and it seats on the fly, and then it's really, really strong. From there, we then go to we fish anything from say 80-pound fluorocarbon to actually 130-pound monofilament. I use perfection loops. The most important thing with a perfection loop is in mono, it does slide, so you need to leave a tag. It doesn't need to be a long tag, so that it creates twist in the line. It needs to be a tag, and you need to seat those knots properly. I do the same thing on the other side with a fly. I do a 9-foot leader, make sure those knots are seated properly. So it's two perfection loops either side. And then obviously the fly is very important, that you need to use a hook that's not going to straighten. So I use, various Gamagatsu hooks, the Trey Coombs 8-0. Or 6-0, I think the SC15 2H, as well, the top one hook in the fiber, the biggest one that you get. Really, really strong, straight point, really strong hooks don't open up. There's various other brands that are also really, really good. And then if you go back on the fly line, back towards the backing, I believe that the right thing to do, for giant trevally is fish 80-pound braid. I know it means that it you lose a lot of capacity on the reel, but you have the ability to survive certain kinds of coral. So I'll put sort of 250 yards of 80-pound braid on the back, and then I join that. I do a bimini, and then I do a double surgeon knot. And then what I do is I join that to a braided loop on the backing the same way. Braided loop on the back of the fly line the same as the other side of the fly line. And for me, that's the best way forward. It's pretty bulletproof.
That's it. You broke that down amazingly. That sounds perfect. So we got the setup. That was awesome. And I love you mentioned the nail knot. That's an old school knot that I love as well. What's the you mentioned the reels. What was it? What was the shell? How do you spell that reel? The first one you mentioned?
Shilton.
Oh, Shilton. Yeah.
Shilton. Yeah. Shilton.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Perfect. Yes. Perfect. And what's so the giant trevally? I'm not sure if you know the fish itself, it just looks so unique and cool, man. It's got this giant head compared to, say, like bonefish. Well, I guess permit, they have their own body morphology. But why the giant trevally? Why the giant? Is it just, do you know a little bit of that morphology? Why it's such a giant head and all the, is it just for seeing and be the predator it is, obviously?
Yeah, I just think, they obviously built to eat. So, they built in a way that they need to be very hardy. They do believe that they are the super predator on the flats. So they will swim with sharks and with rays. And
oh, wow. Really? So they're one of the top predators. They're even alongside a shark.
Yeah. The biggest fish you catch will be on a 10-foot shark, so it's, they feed, you'd have two or three fish sometimes on sharks. And the strange thing about it is that at different atolls, you get them feeding on different kinds of sharks. So, for instance, at Alphonse and St. Francois, we get them feeding with nurse sharks. Whereas in places like Cosmolito and Estove and those kind of places, we don't get them feeding with nurse sharks. They feed with lemon sharks or with tiger sharks, guitar sharks, and so forth. So it really varies between the destinations. They love swimming with thornback rays. When you have a thornback ray swimming along, you'll get at least one GT sitting right in the back of that ray, and it's a symbiotic relationship where the ray sort of disturbs the everything on the bottom, and little fish and crabs or whatever will swim away, and he'll dart off or she will dart off and eat it. So yeah, they do feed in packs. They feed on sharks. They feed on rays. They are feeding machines. The beauty about them is that when they see your fly and they want it, you can see immediately. They turn on and you can't strip fast enough. They will eat it. And the reason why they're such a beautiful fish to catch is because, you're fishing them on full floating lines. So you're casting the fly at them. And when you're stripping, that fly, it doesn't matter how weighted it is, it's going to come to the surface. So you can imagine a giant trevally, a small giant trevally, its head's probably like a foot. But then you get the bigger giant trevally where, you're probably getting closer to like, 2 foot. So you can imagine that their mouth is about 1.5 feet below the eyes. So in order to eat that fly, he's got to stick his eyes out the water and his head out the water.
Oh, my God.
For that fly to be engulfed in his mouth. So it really is a crazy experience. When you're looking down that rod and you're looking straight at that fish because he's coming towards you to eat the fly, you're stripping as fast as you can. He's opening his eyes. They dilated, his mouth's open. And all you got to do now is just pause slightly, just a little bit of a slower strip so you can just eat it, it's exciting.
That is amazing. So, and what is the fly you're using for the GTs?
Oh, various. So we'll catch them from surface poppers, Nyeps, Sempers, Clouses, brush flies. There's a lot of different patterns we use. There's all sorts of
not critical.
Yeah. No, it's all about size and color and profile. And it's also about belief. I'll fish very different flies to some of the other guys, the flies that are tied on their guest rods and so forth. So it's about preference. That's an important part. Just got to believe in the fly. That's all.
Believe in the fly. Nice. Well, I had another question, kind of a random one. I heard that you mentioned Rose Innes is your obviously your last name, but Stewart is also, you have Stewart, right, in your family. That's your Scottish part of that.
Yeah. So both sides of my family are from Scotland, Stewart and Rose Innes. The Rose Innes family came out to South Africa, with the 1820 settlers. So my father was born in South Africa. My mother's side is Stewart, and my grandfather was born in Rhodesia. Sorry, was born in Scotland, and then from there, after the Second World War, he moved out to Rhodesia, and my father went to Rhodesia to fight in the Rhodesian War, and my mother was a nurse, and my father was was injured, and they met in hospital. And so that's the story. And then obviously Rhodesia fell apart, and everybody left. So we came back to South Africa.
And how do you spell the Stuart? I'm just curious because my last name is Stuart, and I don't know my, you know what I mean? I know it's a Scottish, we have some Scottish ancestry. How do you spell your Stuart?
S-T-E-W-A-R-T.
Yeah, it's spelled the same. So that's how mine is spelled. So yeah, so maybe we might even have a, who knows, right? We might have some relative connection there. Who knows?
We probably have a few bricks that belong to us somewhere.
Exactly. Do you like a goat hit in a pub occasionally? A beer or two?
Or two, maybe a bit more.
Exactly. Okay, good. So you are, definitely we're Scottish.
I'm Scottish deep down inside. Yeah, no, I enjoy drink. I like to socialize. Good. The thing is that, you know, I'm very fortunate that, you know, my business is a lot of my time is spent on Alphonse, and I'm working in the office in the evening, and I'm coming to the bar. I'm working in the office, and let me say that again. So I'm working in the office during the day, and in the evening I'm at the bar counter enjoying listening to the experiences of all the guys that have had fishing that day, been fishing that day.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So what's that? I mean, it's pretty much everybody, like you said, has come there for fishing or just the natural beauty. Is that kind of, it's all revolves around that is the off. And how long have you had when did you first create the company, the Alphonse, the hotel and that whole thing?
So we started Alphonse Fishing Company in September 2012, and we purchased Alphonse in August 2013, and that was basically, you know, that period there was when we started Alphonse Fishing Company. And then we only launched the leisure brand or the ecotourism brand called Blue Safari. That was done in July 2018. In 2018, more recent, but you know, obviously, you know, coming from a fly fishing background, but obviously learning a lot about the ecology and the wonderful nature out there, you know, I wanted to try and put the two together. So around the world, there's obviously like a stigma towards fly fishing or fishing in a sense that they don't think that it's conservation orientated. So we're trying to spread the word in the sense that, you know, and everybody needs to explain that, you know, what we're doing is sustainable. We listen to the science. We've got a lot of different projects that are happening at any one time. And when the scientists or the conservationists say to us, hey, listen, this you can't do this, which has never happened because we don't put as too much pressure on the destination. We are really responsible. But if they had to come to us and say, look, guys, look, you need to close season in Giant Valley. Don't go into these kind of areas. We'll do it tomorrow. We'll do it tomorrow. So over the years, what we've tried to do is create this, you know, inform people and just sort of teach people in the sense that, you know, fly fishing is great because it's a good revenue earner, but you can also protect the areas because we need the areas to be pristine. So all the funds which we raise and the conservation auctions that we go to and the trips we donate all go to foundations which we've created in the Seychelles, which are specific to each atoll and protect and monitor these destinations. But they don't, because you know that funding is coming from fly fishing, from guests that are coming fly fishing. Always was guests that were coming from fly fishing and has still been guests that are coming from fly fishing. But it doesn't only protect the marine environment. It protects the terrestrial environment as well. So in the past, we were doing more terrestrial work than marine work, but the revenue is being earned from marine-orientated activities. So now what we've got to a stage now where, you know, people that come to the island, there isn't a stigma that, oh, fly fishing or fishing is bad. Everyone on the bar, you know, the divers, the conservationists, the eco people coming on ecotourism or just the leisure-orientated guests all get on really well. You know, it's like an amazing experience when you come to Alphonse Bar. Everyone's there. We have a bell ringer every single evening where we acknowledge great catches of the day, but also great achievements from the divers or, you know, some divers saw a handmade shark. We acknowledge that. And generally what it is we the person or the activity guy in charge of the activities that day or the head guide would come up and we'd start the bell ringer and we'd call the fisherman up and talk about the trigger fish he caught or the giant trevally he caught or the diver that went out and saw a handmade shark or the guests that went snorkeling with sailfish or the guests that helped hatching turtles or the guest that did a beach cleanup and all that kind of stuff. And it's all acknowledged with a ring of the bell. But what you also get is shot, either a shot of alcohol for the ones that want alcohol, or for the kids or whatever, they get a shot of fruit juice. And it's all a celebratory kind of evening. And that sort of breaks the ice for the evening. And everyone has a point of contact to be able to speak to anybody else. You know, it's like a starting point of discussion.
Yeah.
And our destinations, we built them on the sense of trying to framework them around ski resorts, where in the evening you'll see your instructor in the bar, or you'll see, those kind of things. So we encourage our staff, our dive masters, our conservationists, our guards, all to come to the bar in the evening to socialize with the guests and talk about the day. And that way you get people encouraged to do all sorts of other experiences. And that's why all our destinations are so great, and everyone loves them, and we have 80% return rate. People might not come every year, but they'll come, every 2 or 3 years kind of thing.
Today's episode is sponsored by Rare Gear, not only making telescoping fly rods, but rethinking the whole fly fishing idea of traveling better, lighter, and faster. This rod is a blend of traditional and Tenkara styles to make what you might call the perfect all-around fly rod. It travels well, fits in almost any bag, and because the rod packs within itself, you don't have to worry about damaging it. Rare Gear also has folding nets, compact wading boots, and the telescoping rod puts the perfect package together where you always have it on at all times. Rare Gear is definitely innovating in fly fishing to help hikers, bikers, multi-sport enthusiasts, and everybody out there who wants a new adventure to get on the water faster. You can head over to raregear.com right now to check it out and take a look at this rod. You gotta, if nothing else, click over there and take a look at what this thing looks like. A rod without guides is definitely unique. That's Rare Gear, reyrgear.com.
And that's it. You've created this experience. Obviously, this is, and these trips, definitely, especially for somebody coming across from, say, the U.S., you got to do a lot of traveling to get there. What does that look like for your clients? Does it look like, is it a good chunk of more U.S. folks now than there used to be, or how's that look?
Yeah, we've always been really strong in the U.S., where it's about 40% of our guests come from the U.S., and most of those guests are all fly fishing orientated. A lot of our other guests all coming, from the UK and Europe and those kind of places. There are a lot of fly fishermen, but a lot of them are also leisure orientated because it's a lot easier for them to go to, Seychelles, than American. They had to come to Seychelles to do sort of leisure orientated stuff. So, but we do get a lot of American coming out to do the conservation stuff and to see what we got out at these destinations because they're obviously so pristine and wild. But yeah, I mean, it's hopefully going to, the American market's going to obviously grow for us. We find the American market very easy because, generally they're well-traveled. So they do appreciate, when they come to a destination like ours, they do appreciate what's there because they've seen so many other destinations which don't have it. So, yeah. So Americans are generally great travelers. We're learning all the time. So, yep. We hope that the Americans keep coming. Obviously it is a long way to get out there, but once they're there, it's, they're in heaven. But we do encourage guests that are coming out for a week's fly fishing to come out for a little bit longer. If you had to go to any of our destinations other than Alphonse, for instance, like Estove, Farqua, Cosmolito, Poivre, St. Joe's, the Amarantes, any of those destinations, all those flights come via Alphonse. So you can fly into Alphonse and spend 2 or 3 days before and rest and do a bit of fly fishing and get your eye and so forth, and then move on for your weekly package at one of the other destinations, or just come for a 2 week or 10 day trip to Alphonse. So that's the beauty about it, is that it's not, a lot of fishing packages around the world, you're sort of limited by your time frame. It's either going to be a week or 2 weeks, whereas it doesn't with us. It can be 3 days. It can be up to, as long as you want. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that is really cool. So, and it sounds like, a lot of the people that are coming there are people that have been, traveling around, so that they know it's not their first saltwater trip necessarily. They've been around, and this is like obviously a bucket list trip for a lot of people. But then once they get there, they come back as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's everyone. It's a funny saying where everyone says the trip of a lifetime every year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so what, I'm curious on the, you mentioned the conservation, because that is a key part of it. And one of the struggles I would imagine you hear about some of these things, right, especially out in the ocean, where you guys are doing a great job protecting the species, but then you've got some other group or industry or something that's, right, that's hammering it. Is, do you see that as a problem out there, or do you guys feel like you're able to really protect that whole, all the atolls out there?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's sad to say, but conventional angling is a downer for the flats fishing. You know, if you have someone who rocks up, or a group of guys in a yacht, and they casting conventional plugs across the surface of the flats, you know, they're going to entice every single giant trevally in the area for a mile, you know. And, yeah, you know, one yacht fishing an atoll for a week will catch as many GT as we catch in, you know, 3 months. You know, so, oh, wow. So you can't have that kind of fishing. You know, these places have to be extremely pristine to have giant trevally coming onto the flats. So, you know, if you're having boats rock up and doing conventional fishing in shallow water, it's going to ruin it for everybody. So we've managed to get a little bit more protection with regards to that. So, you know, the IDC, which is a government organization which manages all the outer atolls, they, you know, they obviously help us, you know, trying to, you know, not allow boats to come to these kind of places, you know, inside the lagoons and so forth. So, you know, all the conventional fishing is done away from the reef. It's all done in the deep water. It's all done for pelagics. The giant trevally are protected. Whereas our destinations, obviously closer to Mahé, where conventional guys go out there, and there's obviously way less giant trevally there because there's too much conventional fishing. But we're lucky because our destinations are, you know, it's expensive to get them because, you know, you're obviously going to have to fly for at least an hour. And it's a little bit further out than what your general yacht can do and get out there. So that offers a lot of protection. But the beauty is now as well is that the Marine Protected Areas Act is now being put in place in the Seychelles, where there's Marine Protected Areas, where it disallows that kind of fishing and offers a lot more protection for the fishery on a more sustainable basis, which is fly fishing orientated with rod limits.
And what would be, you mentioned some foundation, what would be one foundation where people could kind of check out and maybe support them or check them out more, or some of the folks doing the conservation work?
Yeah, so I mean, you can go on a website, you know, Alphonse Fishing Company or Blue Safari Seychelles or Alphonse Island, and you'll see that there's some conservation work there. The conservation work that we're doing, the foundations, the names are the same as the atoll. So, for instance, for Alphonse Island and St. Francois and Bijoutier, which is the Alphonse group, we have the Alphonse Foundation. For Cosmolito and Estove, we have the Cosmolito Estove Foundation. And those are the foundations that we sort of generate the income and the donations. And then what we do is we have a tri-party agreement with the Island Conservation Society. And they do all our conservation work. We give them the funds, we allocate what kind of conservation work we would like to happen, and then they carry it out for us.
They do it. That sounds like a good partnership. Right on. What is the time-wise, if somebody, you know, this is obviously a big trip, if somebody was planning something, what would be a good time, you know, and how far out do you have to plan this sort of trip? When should we be coming if you're talking permit and or GTs?
Yeah, so I mean, our best time of year weather-wise, it starts around October and ends now in May. The rest of the time, the southeast wind generally picks up a little bit and starts blowing. We hibernate all our destinations except for Alphonse during from May all the way until August. And then the destinations vary in when we open them up again for the season. Alphonse Island, you can fish all year round. But we just limit the rods. So we like to create a buffer period where we have, you know, the flats being nice and rested so that, you know, when the season comes about, you know, the fish have been rested and, you know, it's like walking onto a flat that's never been fished before kind of thing. But funny enough is that people believe that the off-season rejuvenates the fishery, but it doesn't really. You know, so you can start the beginning of the season and you expect to be like fish everywhere and cost for cost kind of thing. You still have to catch them. And you know, generally the fishing the peaks in the fishing is according to the weather, according to the tides. There's various different scenarios that come into play. You know, if you think, okay, I'm going to go to an atoll and no one's ever fished before and I'm going to catch bucket loads. It doesn't happen.
Yep.
It doesn't happen like that. You've still got to get the stars to align. You've still got to be there when the tides are right and when the weather's right and when the fish are in the right areas and so forth. So even though the Seychelles is a guarantee you're going to catch fish, you know, you're going to catch a lot of them. Some weeks are obviously better than others.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear you. It sounds like, well, like a lot of these places with fishing, you know, it's like we said earlier, it's the fishing is obviously amazing, but, you know, it's the whole everything. It's the experience, you know, somebody traveling there, just being out in that area, seeing the creatures and animals would be sweet. So give me a rough on cost-wise, just so somebody knows. If they wanted to book, say they're going to book a week trip to, you know, Cosmolita or whatever for, say, permit or GTs, what does that look like over there?
Yeah, so I mean, our product ranges from about $10,000 all the way up to about $15,000 or $16,000, depending on the destination. So generally, the price point increases according to the distance of the flight. So the flights are operated by the government, independent contractor, and that's how they sort of limit.
So if you came over from the U.S., if you came over the U.S., you would fly in to – where do you fly in? Like, where does the international – where do you fly in there?
To Mahé Island, which is the main island. It's a big island. And then from there, it's we have Beechcraft 1900, which can seat 16 people, a nice pressurized plane that, you know, can fly above the weather. And, our closest destination is – with the landing strip is Alphonse. And then from there, it's an hour. Two Alphonse in an hour. Then all the other destinations are an hour more. Cosmolita and Estonia. So 2 hour flying. Farquhar is another half an hour, 45 minutes. So Farquhar in total is about an hour 45, whereas Cosmolita and Estonia are about 2 hours, 15 minutes. But all our flights come via Alphonse. So we'll always fly the plane, an hour flight, land in Alphonse, depending on what time of day it is. You'll either have a snack or you'll have a toilet break and so forth. So a lot of people will jump off at Alphonse and some people will jump on at Alphonse. And then we move on to the next destination and land there.
Gotcha. So that's an hour. So that's amazing. Yeah, it gives us a perspective if you're talking 1-2 hours air flight. I mean, this is a huge, gigantic area. What is the mileage wise, do you have any idea how many miles it is between this whole area that you guys work in?
Yeah, so between Mahé and Alphonse is about 200 miles, a little bit more than 200 miles. Then between Alphonse and Farquhar is about another 200 miles, there and thereabouts. Cosmolita is a little bit further, probably like 250 miles. So, and Estove and Cosmolita are very close together. So it's a long way out. You know, you're closer to Madagascar than you are to Seychelles, to Mahé. And that's why these destinations are so pristine, because they're so far away, so difficult to get to, and so expensive to get to. It's just the fact that we are able to do back-to-back trips and supplement the trips with leisure. They were able to get the costing to where it is.
Yeah, that's it. No, it's totally. I mean, for this sort of trip, I mean, price isn't really the issue here. You know what I mean? It's like you said, once a lifetime trip. You know, every year people find the money. You know, that's the great thing.
Yeah, I mean, also you got to understand is that, you know, for instance, let me give you an explanation. So Cosmolita is 5 days by barge. So if you want to send one coke can out on a boat, it'll take 5 days to get to Cosmolita by sea. And we have to use massive boats, which we can fit 10 or 12 containers on, because we obviously are having to take a large amount of provisions out. We do 4 barges out to Cosmolita in a season in 7 months. So just to keep the camp running, you know, obviously – you know, you've got to generate electricity. You've got to make water. You've got to obviously have all your dry supplies. You've got to. There's so many different things. You've got to move boats around, spares. You know, all those kind of things. So it's a massive moving organization logistic wise. So and the Seychelles isn't cheap. It's just logistically it's difficult.
Yeah, that's it. That's cool. And what about another random one here? I mean, I remember a while back you were hearing a lot about these, you know, the pirates out there and things like that. Is that something you've ever had any interactions with, or is that an issue out in that part of the world still?
Yeah, look, piracy is not existing in the Seychelles waters. I don't even know if there's any more of it in the Gulf of Aden, which is near Somalia. I'm not sure if it's ongoing at all. It was basically sorted out. I think the only place that there's now piracy or a little bit of piracy is in Indonesia or on the east coast, on the west coast of Africa, up closer to below Morocco, those places. You know,
gotcha.
But there's no piracy in the Seychelles. I was unfortunately part of the business which I started many years ago, which I sold out of in 2012. We actually did all the pioneering of the outer islands and destinations, and that business came to abrupt halt when we actually had one of our boats taken by pirates. So,
oh wow,
you know, my
you were vision, on it.
No, I was not on it. We didn't have any guests on board either. The guests had been dropped off 5 hours before. But they took the boat and they took the crew of eight, and they took them and they had the crew for 79 days in Somalia. Yeah. They had the crew for 79 days in Somalia, and they eventually burnt the ship, and they closed our business. But then, it was kind of, it was a terrible thing to happen, but it also set a lot of other things in play where, you know, liveaboards aren't the best things for destinations because you can't have a permanent presence there. You know, you especially in Africa, you know, east coast of Africa, boats move around. People can get to these atolls. People can fish them and take turtles and stuff without anybody even knowing. So you've got to have a presence at the atolls and an all-year presence so you can protect these destinations. So by having a lodge that you operate for, call it 7 months of the year, and then you have nobody there except your skeleton crew and your rangers and your conservationists, and you're able to protect these destinations. So for me, it was a migration after having the piracy and seeing the effect of liveaboards and seeing the effect of commercial fishing. And my decision was that I had to try and explain to the government that you have to have low impact destinations, lodges with high income and the ability to protect these destinations. Show people and teach them what these destinations are about and how unique they are.
Yeah.
And by doing that, they're gonna contribute, and you're gonna be able to protect them and protect them for longevity through sustainable use and drive all the commercial fishing away, or illegal fishing or legal turtle catching, sharking, trilling, all that kind of stuff. And through that, all these destinations have been able to be protected, and they're rejuvenated. They're getting better all the time. You know, destinations, the fish are there. You know, the fish are improving. For instance, like the bonefish populations at Saint-Francois are more healthy than they've ever been. That's Alphonse and Saint-Francois, more healthy than they've ever been. The permit fishery is better than it's ever been. The GD population is as good as it's ever been. So evolvement that things are, how things have evolved.
Exactly. And you've been right in the middle. So you've been in the middle of this thing the whole time. I mean, other than, you've built this thing along with, I mean, who else is out there? I know you hear a lot about Yaku, right? Because he's out there a lot. What does your crew look like? Your community of guides, is this people local, or what's that look like?
Yeah, so we try and encourage as many local guides as possible. They're very good. We have some incredibly good local guides. Some of the guides have been guiding with us for like 16, 17 years. We've got a really good local content of guides and really good guys. But we also, we obviously have expats that come in and do guiding stints. It's generally hard to keep people on the outer islands. So it's hard to keep people for long periods of time. So you do get the guide teams moving around. But what we try and do is we try and encourage our guides to stay by moving them from destination to destination. And then they keep, keep enthusiastic about their destination. So they'll spend sort of 5 weeks at Saint-Francois and Alphonse. Then they'll spend like 3-4 weeks in the Stove and 5 weeks at Cosmo. Then a couple of weeks at Farquhar. And then from Farquhar, maybe do like 2 or 3 trips on the liveaboard to the Amarantes. So it kind of keeps them fresh and excited. Yeah, Yaku, and Yaku, he actually cut his teeth with us in the early days.
Yeah.
So, a great story. I mean, I'd been guiding in Russia, and I came back for a break, and I met Yaku as a youngster at one of our sort of coastal towns, a place called Kids Beach, and met him out of the blue, and he asked me, look, how do I get into fly fishing? So I said to him, look, I mean, most important thing is obviously get something behind your name with regards to university. And when you've done that, shoot over to the UK, try and get a job at Follows of Pall Mall in a fly shop, learn as much as you can about all the different destinations. And then when you've done that for 2 years, give me a call and I'll get you a guiding stint.
Nice.
And almost the day he called me and said, Keith, I've done all of that. I want to come guide. So his first day of guiding was he was thrown on the flats. We were at Cosmolito. He was pointed in the right direction. He was given a radio, and he said, "And I said, there's your three clients for the day, and make it happen." You know, so Yaku's obviously a talented guy. You know, he's got a lot of sense between his two eyes. You know, and he's got the ability to figure things out and. He evolved and he spent many years with us guiding in the Seychelles. Yeah, and he's a very close friend of mine, and you know we do a lot of fishing together still. And you know, he comes out to Seychelles for many weeks every year and host groups and so forth. So yeah, he's still a part. Although he doesn't work for us, he's still an integral part of our family.
That's right. Yeah, he actually he ended up grew up, I think, near, well, I'm not sure how close he is to you, but now lives in actually the US down in Texas, I think, is where he moved last, I heard, right?
Yeah, he's guiding out of Texas, yeah.
Yeah, which is cool. No, that's really awesome. I think that I think it sounds like you guys have an amazing program, just like, you know, you hear the name out there, obviously. I'm glad we had a chance to shed some light on it today. So what, now that it's May, what's that look like now the next, 6 months or whatever that is this season where you're not going to be fishing as much? What takes up your time now?
Yeah, so now we obviously planning for next season. So it's getting all the provisions sorted out, rebuilding boats, skiffs, engines, refurbishing accommodation. Making sure that the team's going away and getting well rested as well, so doing a little bit of a rotation of the teams.
Do you get a break in there? Do you like take it out? I mean, you're on vacation all the time because you live out there, but do you ever go somewhere to kind of get a vacation, your own vacation?
Yeah, I do. So this year I'm very fortunate in the fact that I'm going with a very good friend of mine out to the Alta River in Norway, which is it's a very prestigious experience. You know, many people have dreamt about it for, like I have for years, and haven't been able to get the opportunity to go there. It's, you can't just rock up and go and fish, and you can't really even buy a rod to go and fish.
Right. So for Atlantic salmon. Like,
for Atlantic salmon, big Atlantic salmon, the biggest in the world.
Yeah, the biggest in the world.
It's like, there's a saying, it's dead man's shoes. So there's basically, there's a syndicate of 5 weeks where people have purchased the syndicate rods. They pay an astronomical amount of money to be able to go and fish during that period. And then for the rest of that period, there's a lottery. So you have to enter into the lottery job to try and win a day's fishing on the Alta. So if you haven't been lucky enough to get an invite of someone that's got a syndicate rod, which you share, not one person doesn't fish a rod. It's always a shared rod. So two people take turns in fishing that rod, it's very difficult to go and fish the destination. So it's been a lifetime dream for me, obviously, because I did guide on the Pinoy River for 4 years where I was the head guide when I was doing back-to-back seasons with Seychelles. So Atlantic salmon fishing is really, really, truly ingrained in me. I love,
you know,
even not even catching a fish. I love, you know, walking the riverbed and casting a spey rod. Yeah. All day long, and you know, it really is. It's so different to what I do for work. You know,
yeah.
When I'm walking totally in the different. Flats in the Seychelles and I'm holding a rod, I don't find that I fish much. You know, I enjoy it more taking my son out and watching him fish. You know, for instance, the last three or four times I've been in the flats, I haven't even taken a rod with me. I've just been with my son and watching him catching and my wife watching them catch bonefish and whatever comes away, you know. So for me, you know, there's always that sense that it's still work. You almost a sense that you've caught enough fish in the Seychelles, you kind of feel guilty, and now it's time to pass the baton or to rather just enjoy the experience of walking in the flats. So, you know, salmon fishing is so different. You know, salmon or steelhead fishing is so different that you get on the river and you feel, you know, now I can unwind and enjoy it.
Yeah, that is great. What is that on the, and I'm just curious because you mentioned the number before. So you, those rods where people are buying, what does that cost? What's that price tag look like for those, the high end, like, you know, rods?
I've got no idea. It was priceless. You know, the guys.
Yeah, you can't even get it. You literally can't even get it.
The guys hold on to them until it gets passed on and someone wants to sell it.
Oh, right. Yeah, you can't even get it. So it's a lottery. It's literally just a lottery system for anybody. And even that's still a lottery.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, those rods are obviously syndicated and they passed on to generations or they sold on and they're snapped up immediately. And then all the other, you know, because basically those rods will be fishing during the night time because it's 24 hours of daylight. And it's better fishing in the evenings or the nights because, you know, the fish bite better. The daytime period is generally offered to the lotteries. And so everyone, you put money into the lottery and it's a lottery. And someone wins, is lucky enough to win a day's fishing on the Alta. And obviously divided by the amount of lottery tickets that I bought. I've bought lottery tickets and I've never won. So
that's right. That's the problem with the lottery is that I guess depending on your lottery, but lottery is usually not a good investment, right? Usually you don't have a good shot at winning. I guess it depends on the odds, but, this has been good, Keith. I appreciate, definitely digging into this today. We'll send everybody out to alphonsefishingco.com if they want to connect and maybe find out more about getting a trip with you. I appreciate you taking the time today and shedding some light on all this.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, if anyone wants to send me any questions or to send me a hi on my Instagram, I'm Keith Rosiness Fly Fishing. You can just send me a message there or send me an email on keith@alphonsefishingco.com. I'm happy to answer any questions, even if it's just about tackle. I'm happy to chat. I enjoy chatting with everybody. And hopefully we'll see you on the water somewhere. If it's not in the Seychelles, maybe on a river somewhere. But tight lines and good luck out there.
So there it is. wetflyswing.com/335. 335 will get you all the links, the show notes, and whatever Dom threw in there, a little bonus. You can check it out. Quick listener shout out before we get out of here. Tim Martin out of Humboldt County sent me an email recently. And he just found the show actually back in May, and he's been binging the content and loving it. Just want to say thanks for all the support, Tim. I appreciate you for taking a moment to say thanks. If you want to connect with me and potentially get a shout out here, you can send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. It's probably the easiest way, or you can connect with me on social and I will definitely get to your email personally as I get to it. I would love to hear from you and try to put together an episode that makes sense for you. One last one before we get out here, Togan's Trivia Night. Head over to wetflyswing.com/trivia to enter your email and get entered in to get some fly tying swag from Togan's. They're sending these out. We're doing these on a regular basis, so it's a chance to get that free swag, and we're going to be announcing the next winner on an upcoming snippet episode, so stay tuned for that. Hope you enjoyed this podcast. I hope you have a good afternoon, good evening, or good morning wherever you're at, and looking forward to catching up with you online or on the water.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.